Hey everybody, time once again for Flickers of Fear, and yet again, we're continuing with Giallo July. Now this is a little bit of an unusual one. What ended up happening with this was that when I first announced that I was going to be reviewing Giallo movies all throughout the month of July on this Flickers of Fear series, a listener out there recommended a film several times that I had actually never heard of called Discopath. Because it has a title like that and the poster is wicked cool, I was like, okay, well, obviously I can't resist checking out something like that. And they were like, hey, review this for your Giallo month because it kind of fits in. So it's available for free on Tubi, so I kind of toddled over there and gave it a watch. Now, I will say that Discopath isn't exactly a Giallo film, though it is pretty heavily influenced by kind of tropes of the genre. It's actually kind of more of a straight up slasher movie with sort of like a throwback 70s vibe. So this movie was actually written and directed by a guy named Renaud Gauthier. Hopefully I'm kind of pronouncing that right. This was actually his film debut. I think he's made a couple of other films subsequently. This is a French-Canadian production, and it premiered first at the Fantasia Film Festival in Montreal back in 2013, and ended up opening in the United States, limited run, obviously, at the American Cinematheque in Los Angeles. And it was actually, they put it on a triple bill with the 1982, like, slasher movie Pieces, and the 1980 classic Canadian slasher Prom Night. So that would have been a really good triple bill to see back in 2013. So we start out, we have, like, this really, really groovy title sequence that utilizes the excellent 1976 song, which is called Flight 76 by Walter Murphy, or the Walter Murphy Band, which is essentially, I'm sure you probably heard it, but it's like a discofied version of like Flight of the Bumblebee. I think my dad had it on, like, on vinyl, like, way back in the day. But yeah, so the opening credits are like set to that song, and it's really cool. So after that, we're introduced to our titular Discopath, who's actually this sort of awkward, not all that talkative young man by the name of Dwayne Lewis. Now, when we first meet him, he's working as, looks like a short order cook or something like that, like in a diner in New York City, but he's clearly not really cut out for this shit. He's getting like really overwhelmed. And then like a group of guys sort of like stroll into this diner, and they have like one of those big 1970s boom boxes, and it's blasting some of that newfangled disco music that we all love so much, that the kids love so much today. And hearing that, it sort of sends him into this kind of like trance, and he spaces out, and it ends up culminating with him starting like a little bit of a fire on the grill. And so the owner of the joint is just like, you know, you can't do this. Just get the fuck out of here. You're fired. So he just like takes off. So as he's sort of glumly contemplating his recent joblessness in a nearby skate park, not so much skateboards. I guess there's kids on skateboards, but it's mostly like people roller skating, but it's clearly like a skate park. So while he's there, Dwayne actually gets approached by this hot brunette on roller skates, and her name is Valerie. Now, she, like, I think she either remembers him from a street they used to live on, or she's seen him at the diner or something like that. But anyway, she kind of recognizes him, and she's like, oh, I always thought you were cute. So she, like, you know, comes on real strong, and he's just, like, very awkward. You know, he's very awkward, so he's just kind of like, well, okay. Yeah, so there's that kind of thing. So even though he's not really talking all that much, and even though he's being kind of, like, weird because he doesn't really have a lot of social graces, and even though her friends are just kind of like, him? Okay, whatever. You know what I mean? And they're just like, we're getting out of here. You just do whatever the fuck, Valerie. But she actually ends up digging him enough to invite him back to her apartment for a beer and probably other things as well. You know, considering how, like I said, very forward she is. And shortly afterwards, she actually persuades him to accompany her to a discotheque called Seventh Heaven that evening, which is apparently a place she's a regular at. Now, she even loans him some kind of like Saturday Night Fever looking threads, you know what I mean? She said, oh, it was my dad's, and it's just kind of like, you know, it kind of looks like that, you know, John Travolta kind of like outfit. And so Dwayne is pretty weakly, like, trying to protest. He's like, I'm trying to get away from the music. I'm not really into music. I don't know anything about it. But she's, like, kind of super pushy. You know, she's trying to get him to go out and have a good time because she likes him. And her pushiness is actually an attribute that will directly lead to her horrible demise. dies. Spoiler alert. Now, interestingly, the murder itself, because she does get murdered. This is a slasher movie, but it isn't shown right away. So it's like interesting how this movie is structured. What happens is instead we like skip from Dwayne and Valerie like going into the club, and then we like just jump ahead to the following morning, and we see Dwayne, who's obviously very panicked, and he's kind of scrambling to like get rid of his blood-soaked clothing, and he's kind of like reaching in the pockets. I don't think the clothes are his, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, but he like reaches into the pocket and there's like a severed hand in there, and he's almost just kind of like, oh my god, what the fuck did I do last night? It's almost kind of like that kind of thing. Thankfully, it's like I've had nights where I drank a lot and didn't really remember what happened, but I'm very happy to report that I've never pulled anyone's severed hand out of one of my pockets the next day, being like, oh my god, what the fuck did I do? But that's essentially what he does. Then he uses the money and the identification from a wallet that he stole from the club's owner, because I think the jacket that he's wearing, he actually got it from the club owner somehow. They don't actually show that, but you know, it's just one of those things where it's like, oh, it's the morning after. You kind of have to like put the pieces together what happened the night before. So because he has the money and he has the ID, and there's also a passport in there, which is convenient, then he kind of books it to the airport and he gets a one-way ticket to Montreal, leaving New York City behind for good. Now, Valerie's actual death, which is shown later but like as a flashback, it's probably this scene in particular, and probably like a couple other ones too, but I think it's this scene in particular that kind of gets this one associated with giallo movies, because her death is actually, I think, one of the best sequences in the movie. And it's very, very much like something that Dario Argento would have shot like back in the, you know, early to mid 70s. It's kind of like Valerie obviously has her hand cut off, like, you know, he hears disco, like the groovy beat or whatever, and then he starts flipping out and he starts chasing her, and then he basically like cuts at her hand until it's almost chopped off, and then she's like running away, and then she actually ends up trying to hide from him, but the place where it is like underneath the dance floor. It's almost kind of like this little, I don't know, like this little cabinet thing that she crawls into, and it's like underneath the dance floor, because the dance floor in the disco is clear, and then there's like all these colored lights like underneath it. So it's like when all the lights are on, like it looks like, oh, with all these lights, colored lights like coming up through the clear dance floor, it's like really cool looking. So she's actually like underneath the dance floor while all these colorful lights are flashing and all the disco beats are pulsing in the background, and just all these oblivious dancers are just like boogieing away like inches above her dead body, like while she's kind of like, you know, scraping at the floor, like trying to get people to pay attention, but it's too loud in there. So that's like really, really a great sequence. Very, very giallo-esque, like with the lighting and the color and everything like that. So after a brief scene where the NYPD kind of fruitlessly attempt to solve the crime, the movie kind of like takes off in a different direction, which I actually wasn't expecting. So I thought that was like kind of interesting. It actually moves from English to French, because like I said, this is French Canadian. It was shot in Montreal, Quebec. And not only does it switch from English to almost all French now, but it jumps ahead to 1980. Because like I said, at the beginning, it's set in like 1976. So Dwayne is now using the name Martin Lopez, which was the name of the club owner whose ID he stole. So he has been working as an audiovisual technician at a private Catholic girls' school in Montreal, Quebec, where he ran off to after he killed Valerie. And he's been wearing hearing aids in both ears, and all the staff of the school believe that he's a deaf mute, but the only reason that he wears them is so that he can block out like any sound, you know, so he doesn't take the chance of like hearing disco music again and, you know, making him flip out and go on a murderous rampage. Not surprisingly, the homicide-free lull that Dwayne has experienced for the past 4 years while he's been working at this school is not destined to last, and it isn't too long before students, teachers at the school, as well as a couple of dancers on a local TV show, which is called Discomania, end up falling into the crosshairs of his deadly mirror ball of murder, if you want to call it that. So this was a very odd, but also like kind of an enjoyable little movie. It's very clearly low budget. I don't know how much the budget was, like the Wikipedia page didn't say, but it was obviously made with a lot of love for the giallo and slasher movies of the 1970s and 1980s. It has like a really cool like retro look to it. The premise is, of course, naturally ridiculous, but interestingly, the film is played almost completely straight. Like, it's not. So I don't even know if I would call it, like, overtly a horror comedy, even though, like, the premise of a serial killer who goes into a trance every time he hears disco and starts killing people is, again, essentially ludicrous, but it's mostly played straight, and I think to a large degree that works. The only thing that's a little bit weird, and I think this makes, like, the tone a little bit uneven, is that some of the cop characters, like the characters playing cops, are just, like, slightly over the top. So it almost seems like the guys that are, like, the cop characters almost seem like they think they're in a comedy, but not, like, overtly, you know what I mean? Like, but they're more aware of, like, being in a comedy. But everybody else, like, including the guy that plays Dwayne and all that kind of stuff, are acting, like, really, really serious. So the tone is a little bit weird. But like I said, I think it's listed as a horror comedy, and I don't know if I would go that far. Yes, the premise is ludicrous, but it's mostly played as a straight slasher, and I mean, there's kind of like little funny bits in there, but it's not like overtly a comedy, if that makes any sense. Like, it's kind of hard for me to explain. Also, I will note that some of the obviously Canadian actors are trying a little too hard to sound like New Yorkers, like at the beginning, like at the first part of the movie that's set in New York City, especially like the girl that plays Valerie. I mean, it's just very, very, I know some New Yorkers have very, very thick accents, but I think they were trying way too hard, and you could tell that they were Canadians, and I know that they didn't really want to sound like Canadians because Canadians sound like Canadians, but it just seemed like they were trying a little bit too hard for like that over the top like New York accent when they probably should have just like chilled out about it. But to be honest, that just kind of like added to the movie's charm, I guess, because I don't know, there's something about like some Canadian, particularly Canadian horror movies, where they're always trying to make it seem like the United States, even though it's clearly Canada, and even though all the actors are clearly Canadian. But I think like the funniest thing about that to me was that there's like a very brief kind of like, I guess it was like a joke, like a scene where Dwayne, like after he kills Valerie and he goes to the airport, like to fly to Montreal, there's a scene where he's like going to the gate or whatever, and this small marching band that's carrying this massive like American flag behind them, like just comes through like the airport playing Yankee Doodle Dandy. And I was just kind of like, and I think, I mean, I'm pretty sure that was done on purpose, because like I said, there is kind of a tradition of Canadian horror films in particular, kind of like putting little American flags on, you know, on police officers' desks and stuff like that. It's like, this is for real America. It's not Canada. And so I just thought they were kind of making like a little nod to that, which this very obvious like marching band, why would there be a marching band like in a fucking airport playing Yankee Doodle Dandy of all things? Of course there never would be. But I just think that was like kind of funny. But so the humor is kind of like that. It's kind of just like the little subtle kind of touches, which I actually really appreciated. Now, another thing that's interesting about this is that the kills actually start out kind of slow. Like I said, he kills Valerie first, but they don't even show that until later. And even though the sequence where she gets killed is really stylish, it's not all that gruesome. I mean, she does get her hand like kind of torn off, and that's kind of gross, but it's not like super over the top. But the movie gets a lot more violent and a lot more like disgusting like as time goes on, which actually kind of surprised me, but like in a good way. The special effects work, for considering what the budget probably was, is actually quite good. A couple victims get beheaded, and you know, the guy like carries the heads around and does all kind of crazy shit with them, like putting them on turntables and stuff. The bodies get like pierced with vinyl records, like 45s, in actually what is a really good scene, like them sticking in there. It actually looks really realistic. There's a great scene toward the end where there's like this big, you know, he's kind of like in a car and he's trying to like hit all the people like in the funeral, like some of the victims that he killed, and he hits one car and like one of the bodies like comes flying out of the coffin, and the head had been taken off, and so obviously it was sewn back on, so it's kind of like hanging off like that, and that was like actually really, really good. So, you know, and the car crash actually looked realistic. There's a point where someone falls off a building and makes like a really nasty mess on the street below. So this does, it doesn't start out with like a lot of violence or gore or something like that, but it kind of like more than makes up for it toward the end. Like it gets really, really gory like toward the end, which I really liked. So, you know, while Disco Path is not strictly a giallo because it's not really a murder mystery, I mean, there's no mystery about who the killer is. It's obviously Dwayne. I mean, they don't make any secret about that. But it does have enough giallo-esque touches to maybe kind of endear it to fans of the genre. Like the look of it, the style of it, the retro vibe of it, I think that's more in keeping with giallo rather than it having like a lot of the plot points around it, like I said, with the mass killer and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, keep that in mind. And also, if you really like, or if you'd really like to see a pretty well done homage to, you know, kind of the slashers of yesteryear, then you'll probably dig this as well. As I mentioned, the tone is a little bit uneven. You know, some of the characters seem like they're sort of aware that they're in a comedy, and the other ones are like playing it straight, so it's a little bit odd. There are a few parts of it that, you know, that don't really work, or there's a couple things in there that I kind of wish had been explored more, but they weren't, because the movie isn't really that long. It's only like 85 minutes. But I mean, those are pretty minor quibbles. I thought this was like a pretty enjoyable movie overall. Like, it has a really cool look to it. You know, so I thought it was pretty nifty. Also, I have to give a big shout out to the score and like all the music that was used. There's some Casey and the Sunshine Band in there. There's Boy from New York City, that song, I can't remember who does it. And like I said, Flight 76. So there's like a lot of really cool like disco music in it that you will recognize. So I really like that as well. I heard, I don't know if this ever happened or not, but I heard that the writer-director was going to put out a soundtrack album like on vinyl for this movie, which would actually like be pretty rad because, like I said, there's a lot of really good disco tunes in this. So yeah, if you like disco, if you like 70s era slashers, if you like giallo films and want to see something that's a little bit like a giallo film but not exactly, then this would be a really, really good one to check out. And like I said, it's available for free on Tubi at the moment. So that will do it for this Flickers of Fear. Again, continuing on with Giallo July. And I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.